Okay, we'll begin today with somebody's provided me with a deep thought here, a real inspirational. Is this from Mr. Barnett? Is this who this came from? There we go. We caught the guy. There we go. My inspiration for today is don't put off until tomorrow what you can do today. Who knows? You may like it, and then you can do it again tomorrow. Yes, thank you. Did I put the right emphasis in it? I hope that I did. I will save this. Okay, well, let's see. What was I going to do today? That the primary concern is form, and then that includes such things as the style, the appearance, proper transitions, also footnotes, bibliography, charts, diagrams, illustrations, anything that you can add to your paper that will make your paper more interesting. You want to add valuable points of information. You don't want to just be adding things to make your paper bigger. The real thing that we're speaking about here is learning how to go step by step to accomplish something. Now, I know that it's difficult at times, I suppose, for some of you to see the value in all of this information, but these things are valuable. Whether you see it or really understand it or not is, at least not at this point in time, the question or the issue. They are important things, and they are valuable things. And a lot of these things will help you in the future. They'll help you with future assignments. They'll help you in the ministries that God will have for you. So don't disdain them. Don't disdain assignments. Don't disdain reports. Don't disdain the things that you're having to do in Bible college. Look upon all of it with the attitude that it's helping to prepare you for ministry, for the things that God would have for you to do in the future. Now, the next thing that I want to give you here is a list of what a complete paper includes. Now, each one of these things is not essential in every paper. You'll more or less have to decide what you think is important and what things you don't think are important in certain instances. Now, every paper, let's say that is taken more as a term project, it should have some sort of a cover. That's just part of a paper. If it's just an assignment that took one page or two pages, well, then there's no real sense in putting a cover on that. But if it's a term paper, then a cover is a good thing to have. Then the second thing is a title page, and we'll talk about a title page here in a little bit. Then technically, after the title page, you're to have a blank page. And this is what people always want to add blank pages to make their paper a little bit thicker. So here's where you can do it. Then in many, many papers, the next thing would be a preface. Now, preface, P-R-E-F-A-C-E. Now, in some places, you'll find them say, well, no, instead of a preface, it should be a foreword, not forward march, but for, F-O-R-E, then word, W-O-R-D, foreword. But other people say that a preface and a foreword are the same thing. And from one English book that I looked at, it says the terms preface and foreword are now used interchangeably to refer to matter at the beginning of a book in which the author, editor, or publisher explains the purpose and scope of the book, gives information which aids the reader in understanding the book, acknowledges indebtedness to certain authors or whatever. The main purpose of a preface or a foreword is to give the reader a basic explanation of your purpose in writing what you have written. It can be very, very helpful to have that kind of information at the beginning of the report. Yes? Yes, it can be, but sometimes it can be taken from a little bit different point of view. You can make it one in the same. If you want to make it as your introduction, then as you just start your paper, you wouldn't have to put an introduction there. You could just start right with the main body of your report, and the preface would serve as the introduction. If If you want to say some things in the preface as far as sources that you've used or people that you talk to that you're indebted to for what you've been able to come up with, well, then you could put that in the preface. Leave the preface as that. Stop right at that point with the preface. And then in the introduction, explain the overall purpose and goal and way in which you're going to go about dealing with your subject. So in some cases, the preface and the introduction are really interchangeable, as well as preface and foreword being interchangeable. Yes, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You can explain that there. That would be real good to explain. There you would be telling who you've actually written the paper to. So that would be fine. That would be a good place to put it. Yes, another hand, Craig.
Is the forward sometimes something that someone else writes?
See,
the preface is written by yourself.
Well, it can be. The problem is that when you go to different English books trying to find out their definition of preface, of foreword, introduction, or whatever, the definitions are not always the same. They vary quite a bit. And in some cases, they'll tell you that major universities set their own standards for term papers and term projects. And so you have to go by what your university has said. Well, we haven't taken the time to go through and say a preface is this, a foreword is this, because it really doesn't make that much difference. But it's understand that it is good at the beginning of your paper to explain what you're really doing, who you're writing to, if you've used certain sources that have proved invaluable and you want to give credit to those sources at the very beginning of the report, well, then this would be a good place to have it in the preface, or you can call it the foreword. Now, in some cases, it is true that somebody else, I think, will write the foreword, and then you would write the preface yourself. But I don't think you're going to do that too often. You could have your wife write the... If I was you and I had a report due, then I'd have my wife write the report and I'd write the foreword. That's personally what I would do. But now that might not be acceptable.
My daughter gave the conclusion.
Yes, your daughter could give the conclusion. Now, you might have to tell the teacher that the conclusion won't be coming for a few years, but depending on the age of your daughter. And if I'm not mistaken, it will be a few years before your daughter will be able to write the conclusion. But that's fine. That's not procrastination. That's good planning. That's good planning. Okay. The thing that comes after the table of contents, after the preface, is the table of contents. Now, not every paper, of course, would have this preface, so it's whatever you really want to do with the paper, but at least that gives you an idea of what it's for. So then you have preface and then table of contents. Now, the table of contents, the best thing on that is just you're wanting to be able to give the reader clearly the main parts to your paper, so that then they can see exactly what pages those parts begin on. And probably the best way of doing a table of contents is finding a number of books in the library that have well-done table of contents and just trying to pattern a table of contents after them. There's no specific way of doing it. You can look in 10 different books and you'll see that they've set it up 10 different ways. But the main thing is to get across to the reader where your topics and subtopics are in the paper so that they can find those things quickly. Now, after the table of contents, if your paper includes any charts or illustrations, then this is where you would give a list of those charts and illustrations. It would be on a separate sheet of paper. You have table of contents. Now, in the table of contents, in the table here, you would have, let's see, this would be, a lot of times they do it with small Roman numerals, so like two small I's. This would be the second page of your material, because the preface, and you can put dots in, like that, the preface would be page number one, Roman numeral, small Roman numeral, and then list of charts, abbreviations, tables, illustrations would be Roman numeral three. And then after that comes the actual your actual paper. So that's the way some would set it up. You'll see different ways that it's done, different books. There's no real set way. And why in the table of contents you would tell the reader that the preface is one page before that makes no real sense to me. Hopefully he passed by it on the way to the table of contents. But you can't take all of these things for granted. You just never know who's going to read your paper. It might be me, and I could never find the preface without having it listed here in the table of contents. So you just never know. All right, well then after this list of tables and illustrations, or list of charts and illustrations, you launch off into the main, your paper itself. And normally the paper includes introduction, main body, and conclusion. And really, for the most part, a preface is just not necessary, because you would give the information here in the introduction that would be included in the preface. Now, if you'd rather give that introductory information in a preface and then just begin right with the main body at this point, that's fine. It's entirely up to you. Okay, so but you do have, normally the body of the paper has introduction, the main body, the actual text of your paper, and then the conclusion. Now, if you decide to put footnotes all at the end of your paper, where you just list them all together on one sheet or two sheets or whatever, instead of putting them at the bottom of each respective page, if you have footnote number one, if you want to put them at the bottom of the page, well, then you wouldn't have a whole list of footnotes at the end of the paper because you've taken care of it all the way through. But in some cases, it's easier to just put all the footnotes at the end of the paper. If you do that, the footnotes come right after the conclusion of the paper, and they start on a separate sheet of paper. See, there's a number of ways of doing footnotes. If you set up your paper with a number of chapters, you can choose to put the footnotes at the end of each chapter. Just list them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, however many you would have in that one chapter. Or you can always put the footnotes at the bottom of each respective page. If you have in the text itself on any given page, you have footnote numbers 1 and 2, well, then at the bottom of the paper, you'd have footnote 1 and footnote 2. That's why you see it in a lot of reference works. But in other cases, you find all the footnotes at the end of the paper, just numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, however many, and that's how they're listed, right at the end of the paper. If you do it that way, then they go right after the conclusion. So you'd have the introduction, main body, conclusion, and then footnotes. So there's three basic ways that you can do footnotes. Not too many of the papers that you write in Bible college are going to be divided into numerous chapters. So there's really not going to be any opportunity, unless you write a thesis, to put footnotes at the end of every chapter. Most of your papers will be, so to speak, one chapter, and that's all it is. So, yes, Brenda. You can do it that way. I personally would put introduction, but then as far as main body, when I get to that page where I start the real writing of my paper, I'm not going to put main body at the top of the page. I'm not going to put that there. And I wouldn't put that in the table of contents. Maybe I'm right at this point. I'm dealing with David's victories or something. That's what I would put in the table of contents. And if this takes four pages, I'd put page 2 to 6 or whatever. So that's what I would. And I would want to put things like this in my paper so that the reader could see these. I might put it all in capitals or something. I don't understand what you mean. Well, let me put it this way. If you're a real good writer, that's fine. But most people, when they just put it all together, that's what they do. And you can't tell what really is introduction. Their conclusion is just that they've finished writing. That's their conclusion. They're just done. They reached the last word and they misspelled it and put a period. A lot of times they misspell it with no period. So it depends. I personally think that to gain a feel for what you're really doing, it's maybe good for a while, if you've never done it, to distinguish very carefully. On page 1, introduction. On page 17, conclusion. And have those as separate pages to your report. Now, if you're more skilled in writing, you can just incorporate the introduction right into the beginning of the paper and the conclusion right at the end of the paper. But you want to make sure that you have introductory remarks to your paper. If you want to put those in the preface, that's fine. If you don't want to have a preface, make sure you have introductory remarks to the paper so the reader can glance through those and know essentially what you're doing in the paper. And then at the end, you have concluding remarks so that the reader knows what you did with the paper. Now, it sounds redundant, but if you've read things that you've really been able to understand, usually they've been redundant in such a way that you never noticed that they were. But they were very repetitive. They repeated things a number of times so that the point could get across. Things that you don't usually understand are when they make one point and go on to something completely unrelated to that, and then they keep building that way. You never can understand what they're doing. So most people need to get it in their mind, introduction, main body, conclusion, and more or less put that right in the paper. I don't think there's anything wrong with writing introduction and having that on a separate piece, and writing conclusion and having that on a separate piece of paper. It's very easy for a reader to follow it, at least. Yes, Virginia. Mm-hmm. Right. You can do it. See, in that, you would explain, this is what I'm doing in the paper, and then you could have the background incorporated right into that. See, there's a number of, for you to understand, there's a number of ways to go about this. It isn't just one set pattern. But the primary thing, as far as the function for the introduction, is to tell the reader what you're doing. And then you might give background information to the overall subject that you didn't really want to put in the main text of the paper. So there's a number of ways to go about it. But that is, didn't mean to confuse anyone. Okay, now after the footnotes, if you do put those at the end of the paper, then you would have the appendix. Now, some papers really need to have this. An appendix would be additional information concerning the topic of your report that didn't really fit into the main text of the report. It's additional information. It's over and above what was really necessary. But you decide that it's valuable, and so you want the reader to have it, but it didn't really fit into the actual text of the paper. There are a lot of books that have appendix sections. Appendices, I don't know if that's how you say it, pretty close. They do have this in books, reference works. And you will find information, let's say you're studying a specific topic, you'll find information that really doesn't fit in per se with what you're doing. But it is additional information that might be beneficial to a number of people that, let's say, would read what you've written. And so you might make reference to it through a footnote. You might footnote it and say, see the appendix section. There's a lot of things that you can do in reports. Footnotes are not just to acknowledge that you've quoted something. Footnotes can be used to give additional information, or footnotes can be used to refer to the appendix, or footnotes can be used to refer to a chart or to an illustration that you might have in the report. You can use footnotes in a number of different ways. If you do have information in the appendix that you feel is valuable, make sure that you let the reader know that there's additional information to be found in the paper in the appendix section. Has anybody ever written a report with an appendix? You all look so dismayed. She all looks so flabbergasted by the whole thing. Patty.
Mm-hmm.
No, if it was time to use footnote number 4, just put footnote number 4, just put a 4 superscript. And then if you're putting the footnotes at the end of the paper, just at that number 4, you put see appendix, page 3, in reference to whatever. Or if you're doing the footnotes at the bottom of the page, you just have number 4 down there, see appendix, page such and such. So you just do it that way. Okay, the next thing would not be in very many papers, and that's a glossary. A glossary. And a glossary is like a mini dictionary. If you have used numerous words that you feel that most readers would not understand, then you need to define those words somewhere. Now, a lot of people try to define those words right in the text, just as they're going along. They use a big word, and then they try to define it right in that same sentence, right in connection with the usage of the word. If you do that with very many words, it really takes away from the paper. It's very difficult to read. It gets very, very boring very, very quickly. So it might be good to acknowledge in the preface or in the introduction that there are a number of words that have been defined fully, and they will be found in the glossary section. And that might be because there are certain words that are easy to use, and it's much more convenient to just put those in the text rather than trying to fill out some long definition every time you get to that point. You might be using the word regeneration, propitiation. You might be using a number of words of that nature, and you're not so sure that every reader understands what the word means. Well, it'll be much easier to just say in the introduction, numerous words in this paper are of a more difficult nature, and you can consult the glossary for full definitions of these words. So the reader, if he really wants to understand what you've written, then he has all the information available. He just has to turn to the glossary and find it. So you can do something like that. Other times, instead of having a glossary, when you have the difficult word, you can just footnote it. When you come to it, and let's say it would be your sixth footnote, so you put a number 6 by it, and then in the footnotes, you define the word. You've seen that in a lot of reference works, I'm sure. Okay, but two ways. One, you can just footnote these and define them there, or you could have a glossary. It kind of depends on how many words you have, how many difficult words. Then another thing which I would think would very seldom be used would be Mary's right hand. Yes, Mary. I wouldn't, no. I would just tell the reader that there are the numerous difficult words used in my paper have been defined fully in the glossary or something to that effect. I'd tell them that in the preface or the introduction. And then they can turn to the glossary and see which words they are. And they'll find, in many cases, your estimation of what a difficult word is, maybe they already know the definition, so they're not going to really have to use a glossary after all. But it kind of depends on who might be reading the paper. Okay, if you do use a glossary, the next thing would be, and I don't think you'd hardly ever use it, would be a list of abbreviations. And this is, if you've used a number of abbreviations in your paper, and you're not so sure that people will understand those abbreviations, well, then you need to have a list that explains those abbreviations. Now, sometimes you find the abbreviations given right after the list of charts or illustrations. So you can put it there if you'd rather. So that means instead of at near the end of the paper, it would be near the beginning of the paper. So instead of preface, table of contents, list of charts and illustrations, and then the actual body of the paper, you'd have preface, table of contents, list of tables, or list of charts and illustrations, and then list of abbreviations. If you've looked in, say, Young's Concordance or Strong's Concordance or a number of other reference works, you find that they use a lot of abbreviations, and they do it just for convenience. Well, The unfortunate thing about some of these reference works is they assume that you know so-called the most used abbreviations, and so many times the ones that you don't know, they haven't explained, because they just use them and assume that everybody knows them. Well, don't you assume that if you ever do such a thing. You might end up writing what might be described as more of a work, of a research work, and it's not written just to be read as more of like a novel or that type of a presentation. It's a listing of facts, of data, of specific points of information, and you might find it much more convenient to use numerous abbreviations in it. Well, that would be fine. You just have to make sure that you give a list of those abbreviations so that the reader can refer to that list. In other words, don't use abbreviations generally in any paper, but if you do because of the type of paper it is, well, then make sure you give a list of those abbreviations so that the reader knows what you've abbreviated. And I hope that you know what you've abbreviated as well. The very last thing to the paper is the bibliography. The last thing, bibliography. And bibliography pretty much speaks for itself. Now, I want to go through and explain a couple of the other points here. Primarily, I'd like to tell you how to do a basic title page. And this can be modified, I suppose. But I wouldn't modify it too quickly. There might be something you have to know about it for a quiz we might have. Well, this is your title page. I'm going to buy some new paper, however. That's pretty good. All right. About a third of the way down from the top, probably about there, huh? About one third of the way down, you want to put the title. The title is the first thing. And you might want to put it in all capitals. That might be nice. And you always want to center it. You don't start over on the right margin or the left margin. You can start on the right margin, I hope, unless you're writing backwards. You always center it. David, man of war. I didn't do too well. That's pretty close. Then, about, now from the top, I'd say about three-fifths of the way down from the top. Hey, you want to put your name? Let's see, should I spell my name like some of you have spelled it? Or? The other day I got Earl Thayer. It's a new one. Put your name. And just so that your name is down a little bit further than halfway, the main thing for the reader to see is the title, not the author. Most people, I suppose, would put their name like to. A report, you know, a little teeny A report done by Earl Taylor. Not really the best way of doing it. So then you have your name. And after your name, you put the date. You don't abbreviate anything on the title page. So if it was January, you would spell it fully and correctly. And if it was today, it's the 23rd, is that right? 1978. Takes about 23 days for me to remember that it's a new year. And then probably the next thing, the best way is, it's a little bit awkward, isn't it? Let's see, about About 1364. About a fourth of the way up from the bottom. See, my poor, I just didn't get this in here very well, but you'll get the idea. You want to put the course, the instructor, and the college. Course, instructor, and college. This would be up a little bit higher. And this would be up a little bit higher. And this would be up a little bit higher. And if I was you, I'd start all over. Just move the paper. Oh, move the paper down. That's right. Move it down. Thanks. I was confused. I was confused. That helped. That really helped. I don't know what to say. That was some real insight. Good luck. What you want to have is title, your name, the date, course, and starting college. Six things. All right, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, six different things. Oh, all these questions. Hands raised. Mike, yes. Bibliography. Well, just a moment. We're still on the title page. We'll go back to it in a second. Yes, Craig.
Should you not put the word by
in the title? Oh, no by. BY is out. You don't need to put by in big letters or anything. Just scratch it. Just put title, your name. Hopefully the teacher will remember his name and your name, and he'll remember that you handed it in to him and that he didn't hand it in to you or he didn't write it, all of that. Hopefully that will be understood. If not, you might write Don a note because we'll need a new teacher. Yes, Tony, not a footnote to Don, no. Oh, everything's centered, yes. Everything is centered. Yep. Some it kind of goes a sloping angle. Centered. The whole thing's centered. Yes, Linda.
Is all capitalized?
No, the only thing that should be capitalized is the title. As far as, you know, my estimation, titles only really needs to be in all capitals. Everything else would be, you do capitalize your name, of course, but capital L, small L, capital N, small D, capital A. That's the way you should write it. No, of course not. Marlene, you had a question? Centering, yes. That's a real good title page. Other questions about the title page? Yes, Mr. Barda. Well, as soon as the test is completed, you can do whatever you want with it.
So, for the test, are those fractions inspired?
No, the fractions aren't inspired. The information that goes on the title page is inspired, though. It's more the information that was inspired. The numbers, the only one I want you to remember is the 1364. The only one that's necessary. And whether that was from the top, the side, or the bottom, that's up to you to figure out. And, of course, there will be a question as to if it's not in the quite the right order, do you move the information up or down, or is it the paper you move up or down? That will be on the paper. I mean on the test. And what you do with it, that's up to you. Okay. Question about bibliography. Mike. Yes. Well, what you should do is the first time that you refer to, say, King James Version, you should write it out, and then you should say, hereafter will be abbreviated as. Then if you refer to New American Standard, write it out, and then hereafter it will be abbreviated as such. It's easier to do it that way. As far as putting those in the bibliography, they're really not needed to be put in the bibliography. Now, you want, when you say when you deal with like Rotherham's translation, you should write out his name and you should write out the title of the translation. And you might say, hereafter it will be referred to as Rotherham's, or I'll abbreviate it ROTH, just referring to Rotherham. So you might do that, but make sure you put Joseph B. Rotherham, the Expanded Bible, if that's what it is. I think that's right. Or Emphasized Bible. Expanded is for Kenneth Wiest. So you do the same thing for if you use Wiest, Kenneth Wiest, Expanded Translation. So you want to make full reference to the work in the text, and then if you're going to use it a number of times afterwards, explain how you'll abbreviate it. But don't put in your bibliography King James Bible. Now, if you use a Bible like the Scofield Bible, where you quoted from his notes, well, then it's become a reference work. But if you use the chain references in your Thompson Chain Bible, don't put that in your bibliography. It's not necessary. Now, if you find something in there that you feel is real valuable and you feel that the author of the Thompson Chain Bible should get credit for it, well, then you might want to put it in your bibliography. But just to quote, you know, to use a translation and then put them all in your bibliography so you have 10 more sources is not, it's not acceptable. There's no reason for it.
Wouldn't that look that up? Change the abbreviation before? Would you just put those
abbreviations? If you want to.
Well,
yeah, but normally it's still better not to even, the list of abbreviations is really, as far as I'm concerned, kind of something that you just use very, very rarely. I think it's better to put it in the text itself, especially if they're not, a lot of people have never heard of Rotherham's Bible. They're not aware of it. Most people only know of the King James and the Living Bible. It's really the way it is in many cases. So they're not very familiar with any of them. And if you use a great number of them, say 15, well, then it might be more convenient to put it all in the abbreviations. Do put together a list of abbreviations and put that in the, you know, right after the list of charts and illustrations. And then make a statement somewhere in the introduction or the first time you use that translation to the effect that the various translations that I'm using, I have just placed in here by abbreviation, consult the list of abbreviations so that you know exactly. A lot of people, though, they won't take the time to consult the list of abbreviations, and they just kind of read through it, and so they miss the importance of the different translations. So that's another reason why in some cases you want to make sure you write it out in the text. But it just kind of depends. Yes, Greg?
Could you put the abbreviations like in your prefix to let them know, like that you were using the certain Bibles and they would be abbreviated as such?
Mm-hmm. You can do that. If it's a real lengthy list, you might want to just put together the list of abbreviations. If it's just a couple, then it might be a good place to put it. In the preface, just put it in that part of it. Otherwise, you can just put it in the text and give an explanation right there. Or you can footnote it. You can write out Joseph B. Rotherham, the Emphasized Bible, footnote number 7 or whatever, and then in a footnote, say, hereafter will be abbreviated as such. So there's a number of ways that you can go about it. The main point to all of this is that you're trying to make what you've written clear to the reader. That's the main point. You are not writing it for yourself. You're writing it for somebody to read it. You know, most people don't write things with that in mind, especially when it's reports and assignments. They don't do it for anybody else but themselves and to get the grade that they kind of want on it. That's about all they do. It's not much of a vision as to what you're doing. Yes, Mike? Well, anything you footnote would be in the bibliography. Everything that you have actually used, where you gained substantial information, not that you read it and it sounded good and then you never made any reference to that information. So if you use extensively Ellicott's Commentary, Smith's Bible Dictionary, ISBE, Lang's, those have to be in the bibliography no matter how many times you quote them and make reference through footnotes to them. You still have to put that information in the bibliography as well.
So what are there things that you'll be putting in the paper that will come from sources that you won't be footnoting, and what kind of things exactly do you need to be putting in there?
Footnotes are direct quotes. Mm-hmm. Anything that you paraphrase is not footnoted. The only thing that you footnote are direct quotes. Now, if you want to use a footnote to give an explanation, that's fine. And if you want to give a footnote to clarify an abbreviation, that's fine. Or you can use footnotes for a number of other things besides just quoting. But anything that you quote specifically must be footnoted. If you paraphrase something, you don't necessarily have to footnote it. You might want to give credit to an author at that point, but that's entirely up to you. You don't have to.
Okay, then you don't have to put a footnote.
No, but that, since you got that information, say from Unger's Old Testament archaeology findings, well, then you would have to have that in your bibliography. You're wanting to make sure that everything is given credit for, but you don't give credit to every point specifically right at that time. See, just what you've quoted is footnoted. Yes, Brenda. Do you have that little book, Preparing the Research Paper? It gives you about 10 or 15. And you will have opportunity. After you hand in your assignments next week, I have another assignment. Yeah. Another little one. Yes, Wayne.
Is there any particular preference to scriptural quotes where you list
what
chapter and verse
you're
last?
You're quoting a verse. The easiest thing normally to do, unless you write, say, in Ephesians 6:18, it says, or Ephesians 6:18 says, if you're just putting together the Word of God emphasizes this point by saying this, then you just quote it, and then in parentheses you'd write, you only have to abbreviate the book. But if you're not really sure, some abbreviations are a little bit difficult for people to discern. It's best to write the book out. But like in our publications, I think they have an accepted list of abbreviations for the books of the Bible, and they always follow that. But normally it would be best to write it out, say Ephesians, Galatians, Colossians, James, John, whatever. But if you don't say in this book and say in, and then give the title of the book and the chapter and the verse, well, then it's best to put it in parentheses after you've quoted the verse. That's what I would recommend. Shannon.
When you have an assignment, they limit no more than 20 pages. They're not talking about
it's the main,
just the stuff that you're writing.
It's, well, as far as I would be concerned, it would be the introduction, the main body, and the conclusion.
So you can have hundreds of extra pages
on the title page, table of contents, preface. 12 pages of bibliography, 48 pages of footnotes, a picture of your grandmother, a baby picture. You can have a lot of stuff in there, right? First time you fell down. Piece from your last birthday cake smashed between pages 14 and 15. You can have a lot of things. I don't think you'd want to put all those things in there, but you do have a lot of things to choose from, yes. Yes, Fanny. You can have them interspersed. You might have them all in the appendix section. You might have some typing on one page, and at that page a certain chart or a certain diagram of some sort was very, very appropriate right at that point in the paper. You might put it right at that point. So in the list of illustrations, if that's on page 7, you'd have chart concerning, and you should try to title the charts. Like one fellow did a report in Leviticus class on the cities of refuge, and so he drew about 6 different maps that were real interesting about the different cities and the location. Well, he should have had technically a list of those illustrations, and map number 1 would be dealing with these cities or whatever, so each one's titled and then giving the appropriate page number.
So you can have it interspersed through. You might have it all in an appendix section. Number of ways that you can do it. Yes, Christy. I would normally do that. You can even do it if you want with the footnotes, and even if you want with the bibliography. It isn't absolutely necessary. It's better with the appendix, I would say, in my own opinion, to have a page says appendix, and you might even give a, in a sense, a brief list of what's in the appendix right on that page. You might do something to that effect, or you could just have. You might even have two pages where you had one that just said appendix, next page gave a list of the information in the appendix, and then the third page would start the actual information. Again, it isn't, see, some would say, oh, you're just trying to make your report bigger. No, you're trying to make it as clear as possible. If there's one thing that's frustrating is opening up an appendix section in a book and really not knowing what's there. And the only way that you can ever find out is by reading the whole book. But in some cases, you know that in the appendix, they'll have some really valuable points of information, but you have to read every page of the appendix to find out what it is. So it can be very, very helpful to have, as it were, a table of contents for the appendix. So again, in every case, what you're doing is to clarify to the reader just exactly the steps that you followed. So that's what you're doing. Yes, Craig?
Are the sections after the main paper, or are after including the main numbers,
I would just keep numbering them the same. Say if your conclusion ends on page 16, footnotes would be page 17, appendix 18, 19, 20. You can just do it that way. That's usually the easiest way of doing it. I suppose in some cases, like I had here with small Roman numerals, 1, 2, 3, in some cases I suppose you could say that the footnotes started that over again, and you could have preface, page 1, table of contents, page 2, list of charts and illustrations, page 3, footnotes, page 4 of the Roman numeral. You could do something like that. But I think it's probably easier for the reader to, once you start numbering page 1 with the where your paper actually begins, then you should just keep numbering consecutively all the way through to the bibliography. So you may end up with 30 pages, but your report was only 16 or something. That's fine. And the additional information, it may not, you're not trying to just add up information. When you're writing the report, you want to put the information that would be helpful. And when you're taking your time following all of these steps, you're going to be much better equipped to evaluate what should go in the text and what should not. And at the same time, you're going to be able to better evaluate what things you would like to still keep with the report as compared with things that you know that really don't have any association with the report. And an appendix section can be extremely helpful for future reference. So you're writing the report not just for yourself. You write it to fulfill the assignment, yes, but you want to write it with a little vision that out in the future you may need to research this topic all over again. And if you've done a top-notch job at this point, then you're not going to be spending the same 30 hours getting the basic points. You can go on from that. So look at reports as valuable things. I have a, at home, I have a whole shelf of reports that I've done. And I've got them all in their folder, and I consult them a number of times. And I made sure that I did a good enough job with each one that they're worthwhile to go back and consult. It'd be horrible to have done 15, 20 reports and go back and know that they're worthless. And to say the least, if that's the way you treat your assignments in Bible college, that's the way you treat the altar calls, and that's the way you treat your prayer life, and that's the way you treat your witnessing, and that's the way you're going to end up missing out with what God has for you. And people say, oh, no, that's not true. But that is true. And that's fact. And it's happened. Many people say, oh, no, Bible college is one thing, Christian life's another. You're crazy. It's the same thing. It goes hand in hand. It's like cheating in Bible college. You're cheating your Christian life. What you do here is indicative of your kind of commitment to God. People say, oh, no, that's not true. It is true. It's absolutely true. Now, I'm not talking about how intelligent you are. I'm talking about what you do with what's been given you. How do you treat the talents and abilities that you have? Take them for granted, or do you use them to their fullest? Is this boring, or does this help you to give, provide you with more insight as to how you can do a better paper, do more research, be more effective in the things of God? Hopefully it does that. I know that it's not the most stirring information, but it is valuable. It's very valuable. Some people just goes right by them, and they can't see any value in it, but I guarantee that it's valuable. There's another book that's available that gives quite a bit more detailed information on doing a report. It's called A Manual for Writers. It's not Emmanuel for Writers, but A Manual for Writers. And it's by a lady with a very interesting last name, Turabian, Turabian. Her first name doesn't really fit her last name. Her first name's Kate, K-A-T-E, Kate Turabian. She sounds like a person born in America that became a Buddhist or a Muslim or something. Kate Mohammed Turabian. No, no. Kate Allah Turabian. No, just Kate Turabian. It's printed through Chicago Press. We have it in the Bible College Library. If you want to get a copy of it, you could have, I'm not sure if Sue Widener is still ordering books or whether Ken Ecker is or who is, but you can check through the office and give them the information about this book, and they'll send away for the book for you, and then you'll pay them for doing all of that, but it won't be any more than what the book costs, so you can do that if you want to add it to your collection of books on how to write a report. Probably the last thing that I want to emphasize about the reports themselves is that you need to take this information, you need to implement it, and then you need to modify it based on your own abilities, your own skills. I'm not saying take this, throw out all the steps that seem to be adding more work, and then do it just the way that you've always done it before. To say the least, hardly anybody knows how to do a report. So hopefully you'll add some of these things to your new established pattern. Now I want to give you a list of some common errors. This list would go on to infinity, but I think I stopped at 24. That's 24,000. Some are more interesting than others, and some are more common than others, but we'll just give you a number of them here. The first one is be careful how you use the word and. Make sure that if you can use commas, use them instead of and. Like, some people would write a sentence, the tears and the sorrow and the grief and the death and the suffering and the pain and the agony are gone. Well, there's just been a few too many ands. There should have only been one and. All the rest should have been separated by commas. So don't be overabundant with your usage of and. Also, don't be overabundant with it as you speak to people. Most every sentence that some people speak starts that very way. And the next common error is the incorrect use of the singular and the plural. And what I mean by this, when you start writing a sentence in the plural, then continue writing it in the plural. If we love him, we will be gentle to others, even though they may get mad at me. Mad at us? Or if I love him, I will be gentle to others, even though they get mad at me. You start in the singular, continue with the singular. You start in the plural, continue with the plural. For the most part, in writing a paper, you should stay as far away from the personal pronoun I as you can. It's best to write it in third person, or just write it in a way so that it doesn't really involve you. A paper is not a testimony. A paper is a presentation of data. So if I found this point to be real interesting, I'm sure that you will find it. I like this. I thought this was real good. I will now tell you, a paper really shouldn't be written that way. It's good you can write in the third person or just present the data. It's a little bit more difficult to write it that way. It's much more fun to put I, but it's not really the best way. Well, we'll continue with this list of common errors. Be preparing yourself for a test. Not next week, but maybe the week after or something. But then don't forget your assignments are due next week. Preliminary outline. Was that complimentary? Oh, that was, it's one of the best jobs I've ever done.
Good morning.
Hi, Dirk.
No, if I was